worked in the field of alcoholism and chemical dependency treatment for about 12 years, and I find it very exciting. And if you want to know more about my personal professional background, feel free to ask me at some point. This will be a very basic kind of description of the dynamics that go on in either an alcoholic family, chemically dependent, and I'll use those phrases very much interchangeably. We used to talk about alcoholism as one kind of dynamic, and then that expanded when we realized that it was too much to talk about alcoholism and valiumism and librimism and morphinism and all the other addictive substances. And so chemical dependency really embraces all of those, and it doesn't really matter what substance we're talking about. They all create a real similar kind of pattern and dynamic. A lot of what I'm going to be talking about can also be seen in any kind of a high-stress family, be it dealing with chronic depression, a chronic illness of some other kind, or where some particular stressful event comes to a family and is sustained for a period of time. Some of you may think, well, gee, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic family, but that really describes mine. And I'll say personally that I grew up with a father who has chronic depression, and very much of the same dynamics went on in my own family as what you'll hear me describe. And sometimes our first thought when we look at a family that seems to be having trouble is to try to pinpoint who the one in the family is that's causing all the trouble. I don't know if that's your reaction, but it certainly used to be mine. And just try to figure out who should we fix, and if we fix that person, maybe our family would be all right. And I was challenged to look at that in a very different way, and you maybe also, in realizing that families are really much more complex than that. And I like to begin to think a family is much like a mobile, and although this is a handmade one, I think it'll suffice and have the same effect, in the sense that a mobile is really much like a family. The dynamics are similar in the sense that a mobile is an art form, you know, and I don't know if you want to call that yet. I didn't make this one, so I may not be very critical, but it's gonna work out fine. It's an art form in the sense that it's free-flowing. The beauty lies in its ability to change and shift and adjust. And when, you know, a current of air comes through the room, we're able, you know, the mobile is able to shift and adjust to that. And what a mobile is always trying to do is to get balanced. It's always trying to achieve some balance. And if you can keep that in mind, a family is very much the same way. And I like to say to people, if you don't write anything else down, I'd like you to remember that everybody in the family is doing the best they can with what they have at any given point in time. And that we're not talking about a blaming situation. We're talking about people trying to survive what's happening in the family. And everybody does that in a very different kind of way. But if you can think of it as a mobile, in the sense that if I were to pull on any one of these parts, what happens to the rest of the mobile? It has to shift and balance and adjust. In the same way, if this were the person in the family that maybe something happened to, you're going to see something happen to everybody else in the family that's going to try to balance the family out. And that's kind of a different perspective than most of the time the way that we look at a family. So if you can kind of keep that in mind as we talk about it, that everybody is trying to stabilize and also to survive, really just to survive that experience. And sometimes when stress comes to a family, that's all that they're able to do. They're really not able to do more than just survive rather than really live freely. So in chemical dependency, we like to look at it as an illness. It's been recognized at that since the 1940s. And something that we've begun to see happen is what we call the family illness, or a disease that we see begin to happen within the family in trying to adjust to that. I'll talk more about that particular topic, especially codependency, this weekend. And there are some other tapes in the library that I encourage you to look at as well, or listen to rather. Because what we see begin to happen is the family develops its own pathology in trying to adjust to what's really happening. And it's predictable, it can be described, and it can be treated. And years ago, people used to just take the alcoholic or the chemically dependent person or the ill person, stick them in the hospital or stick them in treatment and do nothing else to the family. And then try to put them back in there, and all this other stuff was still going on, and we wondered why they didn't recover, or why they didn't make it, or why families continued to get sicker. So the perspective is more now of beginning to look at it as a family condition. Feel free to ask questions as I go along. When chemical dependency happens to a family, we can begin to see some rules and some dynamics happen, or treatment, or symptoms that are going on for everybody. And although we can describe the illness of alcoholism, yeah, go ahead.
Using your mobile as an example, imagine we've got one over here that's made of metal. If I apply a magnetic force on that mobile, nothing's going to happen to it. If I apply the same force over here, I'll get a significant reaction to it. What are the attributes of the family unit that allows one family unit to deal with forces better than others?
Well, I don't know if I can cover that in the next hour, but we can maybe talk about that at the end in terms of, I see, you know, family function as on a continuum, mm-hmm. and from, you know, very high functioning to very low functioning. And there's so many factors that enter into that I don't know that I could begin to even cover it, you know, in any kind of short statement. But we can maybe share some thoughts at the end about that. Some common rules that happen in a chemically dependent family are dynamics, and then we'll begin to talk about individual survival. The first one is the big D, denial. When something happens to a family, especially something like alcoholism or chemical dependency, the first thing that begins to happen is kind of a conspiracy of silence. Nobody wants to admit that it's there or confront it. Oftentimes, families describe it as like there's this big elephant in the middle of the room. Everybody knows it's there, but we all walk around it, we don't talk about it, we even clean up after it, and nobody ever says there's an elephant right here that we have to deal with. It sort of develops what we call a no-talk rule. Let's pretend it's not there. Maybe it will go away. Maybe it's this. Maybe it's something else. Everybody making excuses for it. And that oftentimes, you know, families will, or people are real familiar with the denial of the alcoholic. They say, well, you can't help them until they see it themselves or they admit it. I believe that the denial is often greater in the family. Their unwillingness to see it, to want to confront it, and want to believe that something else is happening. And let's face it, none of us want to feel any pain, and to acknowledge that it's there means we have to feel something. So denial is very much a protection, as well as part of the dynamic that goes on for everybody. We like to believe it's not there. The second one that we often see is compulsive behavior. We certainly see the use either alcohol or chemical of the person who's chemically dependent, very compulsive, you know, driven, and repeated use. But compulsions also develop in the other members of the family. You often see compulsive spending, compulsive eating, compulsive working. Very often we see spouses who are very compulsive about their cleaning. Sometimes religion, I'm sorry to say, can also become a compulsion for people who are in addictive families or dysfunctional families. Sometimes compulsive gambling you see go on. Perfectionism, often children, especially the older ones, will be driven to feel like they have to get always good grades, can't make any mistakes. And so there's a real compulsion that develops as a result of trying to survive what's going on. The other common symptom that everybody in the family experiences now, these are five things that everybody, regardless of whether they're the chemically dependent or the family member, is low self-worth. This is not always real evident or observable, but everybody in the family begins to feel ashamed of what's going on. And they're not very proud of the family in the sense that they don't feel particularly like their family is all that good. And they inside often feel responsible for what's going on and feel somewhat like maybe they're to blame. That's not often verbalized, and it's often covered up in a variety of ways, but low self-worth goes on for most of the people in the family. The second, or the fourth one, is what we call frozen emotions or frozen feelings. And I describe this often as the family literally taking a lot of their feelings and putting them in the freezer and not expressing them to one another. Oftentimes they come out at the time of a death or another severe thing. Being home a number of years ago for my grandfather's death, and all of a sudden some feelings came out from my sister that I never even knew she had had from when we were like 10 or something like that. And it's like the family literally puts their feelings in the freezer. And the process of treatment and recovery, by the way, for each member and together is one of kind of thawing out those feelings and beginning to recognize them and express them. So frozen emotions is the fourth one. The final one is medical complications or health problems. Now you might say certainly an alcoholic or a chemically dependent person is going to have health problems or physical complications, but oftentimes those are now beginning to be diagnosed and seen in the family long before you even see them in the alcoholic. You often see psychosomatic things like high blood pressure, insomnia, unable to sleep, maybe other ulcers, other signs of high stress, and oftentimes they would go in to see a physician for problems like this and just be treated symptomatically. And now people are beginning to ask, you know, what's going on at home? Is there alcoholism at all? And also begin to see these in the children as well. Bedwetting, other kinds of physical health problems. So these five things are usually shared by everybody in the family. They're common symptoms or characteristics. Along with the three rules of don't talk, don't feel, and don't touch. Those are often the three common rules that go along with that. Okay, from that I want to begin to talk about individual people in the family. And I'm going to describe a family that has a mom, a dad, and four children. And I know that not all of you grew up in a family that has a mom and a dad and four children, but what you're going to see is kind of a variety of ways that the family begins to express what's going on. You may see characteristics of yourself, perhaps, in maybe one or two, or you might see other, you know, other families that you've seen, and it's not, I'm not locking people into a particular kind of role, but these are common role or ways of surviving that you'll see in a family. And I'm going to start with the chemically dependent person or the high-stressed person. Not because they're the most important, but that's usually where people begin. Now, from your experience, what are some of the behaviors that you might see on the outside of somebody who is chemically dependent or alcoholic or struggling in some way emotionally? Do you have any? This is just observable now, not what's going on inside.
Anger.
Definitely. You'll see anger. What else? Paranoia, yes. Like everybody maybe is watching their use. Okay.
Rigid.
Very much.
Negative.
Negative. What else? Anything?
Mood swings.
Mood swings, definitely. Anything else? Unpredictable behavior. It's kind of along with the mood swings. Okay. We had rigidity, didn't we? Sometimes some aggression or righteousness. We need to be right all the time.
Tendency to blame others or inability to take responsibility for their own actions.
Right. Irresponsible. That's the word. Okay. Another one that I used to call manipulative. I used to use that word a lot, and because you know I always talk about an alcoholic or a chemically dependent person being a good con artist, and I chose to use a different word for whatever it's worth. I feel like it really describes the dynamic a little better, and that's charming. Mm-hmm. I just think they get really good at charming people around them. Okay, those are all the things you see on the outside. And again, this becomes a real wall of defense against being able to see. Remember the denial and the self-delusion that I talked about. This is all going on the outside. What do you think is going on the inside for somebody who's chemically dependent?
Insecure.
Turmoil.
Very, very low sense of self-worth.
Some shame.
What was the last
shame.
One?
Shame.
A shame, right?
Fear.
Lots of fear. Somebody will find out. Somebody will confront it. What else? Anything else? Hurt and pain and a lot of guilt along with the shame.
A real well person?
Pardon?
A real well person.
Yeah. Now, do most people know about this? I mean, do people around the person know that these are the feelings on the inside?
Sometimes.
Yeah, once in a great while, like maybe after a binge or at a period of remorse, the person might express what's going on the inside. But generally, these feelings are unavailable to the person because of the defenses, you know, that are here. The feelings are just not there. They're unable to express them, and they're not even aware of them. And so if you keep in mind that that's the chemically dependent person, and living in kind of a wall of delusion. And when we talk about the disease of chemical dependency, we talk about it as primary in the sense that it's not the symptom of another underlying problem. It's a disease in and of itself. It's progressive. It never gets better by itself. And it's potentially fatal. Yeah, what were you going to say?
Would you then try to imply that those attributes on the outside of the circle are observed by other members of the family.
Yeah, definitely.
But aware and observed. So
not
you,
always.
Exactly.
Not always. They definitely see the consequences of the person's disease, but not always, you know, don't I see, you know, the symptom. Because they're protecting themselves, will deny it or minimize this, definitely.
So that those around may be exposed to those, but may be oblivious to them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or not acknowledge them, which is what we move into the next person I want to talk about, the chief or the prime enabler. Now this is the person who is is often the spouse, the parent, or the co-worker, a friend, who of the chemically dependent person, and it's the person who's most relied upon by this person here. Whoever this person depends on the most is generally the prime enabler. Now, a lot of times they'll have more than one. But there often is a primary person. And it's a person who also, as the disease of this person grows, so does the involvement of this person. They get more and more caught up in what's happening here. Keeping the mobile in mind, if this person over here is becoming less and less responsible for their own behavior and for their own life, what are you going to see this person over here doing? Yeah. Becoming super responsible. This person, people will often look at and say, I don't know how they do it. You know, they've got all these kids, they're handling maybe two jobs, they're involved at their church, they're doing all these things, and they have this person to live with plus everything else. My, what a martyr that person is. How do they do it? That person, provides for the family. Their primary role, keep in mind to keep things balanced, is to provide a sense of responsibility for the family. That person becomes very much involved in what's going on with this person and develops a real strong sense of responsibility for that person. So what kinds of things do you think you see this person doing? You mentioned one before.
Taking
rescuing.
Rescuing.
Yeah.
Covering up.
Covering up.
Overprotective.
Are they the bottle hiders?
Yep. Covering up. Definitely.
But
making,
I mean,
excuses.
Hiding the bottle from the person themselves. You know.
Sure, trying to control. That's a big one. Controlling behavior.
They play the martyr role too.
They might, yep.
Might be the companion as well.
Pardon?
Might be the drinking companion.
Yeah, very often when both people are using chemical, they kind of, it's sort of like two people trying to sit on each other's lap at the same time. That's sort of what happens. One enables the other, you know, at different points. Anything else?
Guilty.
Is it?
Like they're responsible for what? For the person.
Yeah, a lot of self-pity. You know, why did I marry that person who didn't drink? You'll often hear, you know, from
then
that
they
person.
Divorce them and marry another one.
Yeah, that's why we'll talk about drink. Yeah, self-pity.
They intellectualize a lot.
Yeah.
Instead of talking about feelings.
They're often the people who will buy a lot of books to try to figure things out. Yeah.
They're great forgivers.
Very much so. Very often this person grew up in an alcoholic family themselves. Yeah, they're givers. They're also pretty serious. They're pretty serious and intense. Obviously, if this person is being irresponsible and playful, somebody's got to manage things in the family, right? So they're usually pretty serious. Anything else you think of?
How's their self-esteem?
Pretty low. Pretty low. They often appear kind of powerless. People will come to this person and say, can't you do anything about this person? And they'll be trying all of these things to fix, to control, to hide. And obviously they're not able to, you know, battle the disease, just like it's not possible to, you know, fix somebody else's diabetes. And so they're often kind of will feel sort of powerless, or look even powerless. I can't do it. And yet they're managing all of these horrendous things in their lives. But that self-worth is very low. So they'll kind of feel, along with powerless, is fragile, is another thing that you'll see. Now, keep in mind that this can be also co-workers. It can be friends. I've seen professionals, pastors, physicians get caught up in this same dynamic, trying to rescue and trying to fix. Yeah.
Did we have that?
What was that?
Even children do some of those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not only the spouse, it's an adult.
Yeah.
Can it be that that person, though, I mean, it seems like this is different than some things I've experienced where the person really denies it. It just says, no, it's not really that bad. Other people will say, wow, isn't it tough to be, you know, married to this person who's an alcoholic? Well, no, he's not really an alcoholic.
Oh, or, exactly. You know, they'll never admit that. Because usually what this person has, there's like a smile on their face. Everything's fine in our family. Mm-hmm. They maintain a really good image.
Yeah, and they really believe that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. It's not that they're just covering up for somebody because they really believe it's not a cover-up. It's,
yeah. I don't mean that this is deliberate.
Yeah.
Any way that this is more deliberate. It's all, you know, participating in the whole kind of conspiracy, not deliberately,
mm-hmm.
but really just to survive what's going on. And sometimes people are so much in denial that that's been going on for years. It's very, very difficult to treat because it's just they're just locked into it,
mm-hmm.
and they don't know any other way.
They really aren't admitting that alcoholism is a problem there, are they? Are they really admitting to themselves?
No.
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 So
that would be very painful to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Two cases, a man who lost his wife to alcoholism and a woman who lost her husband to alcoholism. Neither one of them ever admitted.
Mm-hmm.
That their spouses were alcoholics.
Mm-hmm. And like you described, without treatment, the chances are of this person marrying and divorcing this person and getting involved in another kind of enabling situation is almost predictable. And they may not necessarily marry another alcoholic, but they might continue this pattern with a child or with some other person, so to speak. Because the forces are so great, unless they've looked at their own behavior and acknowledged that, that will continue. Which is why we often call alcoholism or chemical dependency a generational problem. It just continues. Yeah.
I say the work I do, that one of the biggest components of the denials, at least with these adolescent girls I work with, is they have no concept that what they grew up in is not normal.
Right.
That is the only experience that they know is that alcoholic family. I mean, that for them is what reality is. Mm-hmm. And they cannot even conceive of it being any different.
When families come into treatment, they're often shocked to learn that this isn't the way it is in every family.
Exactly.
You know, which is why, without family treatment, people just create the same dynamics, you know, again, and it gets repeated. Because we move towards what's comfortable. And, you know, they may unhook from this mobile and just create the same pattern in the room. Please keep in mind that I'm not blaming, and that this is just a process of doing the best a person can with what they know at that particular time.
Over the years, this thing has evolved where you've had more professional and more knowledge, more familiarity with how to treat.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, it's all by hit and miss, by trial and error.
Exactly.
And so these people have done nothing more than try to survive in their own set of circumstances at that time.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there's pastors that try to treat it and help them.
Oh, definitely.
And didn't do anything, they didn't satisfy them.
Right. And that is changing a lot, definitely. Some of the other things with the chief enabler that you'll see, they kind of, along with that martyr thing, is others are always first. You know, not me. I don't. You know, I don't need it. You know, go ahead, sit down. You know, I don't need a chair. And also, they often have a lot of complaints, physical complaints, and they, in their own way, are also charming, like. You know, honey, why don't you take the kids to the store with you? And the real statement is, you know, why, I don't want you to stop at the tavern and drink. Trying desperately hard to try and control, you know, what the other person is doing. And they often appear very controlling. And because of the family illness, then what happens is a lot of people look at this person and they'll say, well, gee, if I lived with somebody like that, I'd drink too. Mm-hmm. That's often the statement that gets made. Because of these. What do you think is going on the inside for somebody like this?
Scared.
Fear.
Lack of self-worth.
Anger.
A lot of anger.
Uncertainty.
Which is smiled through, kind of like, I'm not mad.
Uncertainty.
Yeah.
That guilt playing out.
A lot of guilt. Because this person feels responsible for what's going on with the other person.
Helplessness on their part, they can't do
anything. Nothing will happen. I can't fix it. It just keeps going on. This person usually becomes more and more isolated from friends as well. They will quit wanting to go to parties because of the person's behavior. And, you know, will feel like they just don't want to deal with other people. This person also might begin to experience a lot of depression, trying to deal. Now, some of these dynamics, I want to say, also go on when we're dealing not only with chemical dependency, but maybe also with depression, workaholism, and other kinds of, you know, really high-stress situations. Okay, anything else about the chief enabler? And this person realizes that there's more and more, there's a lack of control, and they'll begin to make a lot of choices and decisions for the rest of the family because this person is kind of abdicating that responsibility. And they become kind of the more powerful one. Okay, now I want to talk somewhat the other thing is this person's always tired. You know, that's another thing that they're often saying. Is there
Why wouldn't that person be? That prime enabler abandon.
Pardon?
Why wouldn't that person abandon family or abandon the situation?
What do you think?
Gives them a purpose to be in that family.
Security.
Mm-hmm. Feel needed. Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you failed. If you abandon, you failed at that point to bring the other around.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still safe. That's what they know.
It's familiar. Especially if they came from an alcoholic family.
Well, until it becomes abusive, until there's, they probably wouldn't, you know, it's out of control as far as...
People will stay in that for years.
Yes.
Go ahead.
What if they pretend they don't care? Is that part of the denial?
Yeah, and the hopelessness, perhaps. Sometimes in treatment, we do an exercise where we have the person who's chemically dependent standing up on a chair, and the person who's the chief enabler standing in front of that chair with the person in the back leaning, you know, feeling the weight of that. And as the person whips the chair around, you'll see the chief enabler move right around with them, you know, staying under there, and we ask them, why don't you move? And, you know, well, if they did, this person would fall on their face, you know, and would have to face the consequences of their disease and how humiliating that way, you know, might be for that person. So they'd rather carry the burden of that. It's familiar. Okay, I want to talk about the children now and how they survive very often. And I'll start with the first person who is often old, I'll begin with the older child, and this is a person we call the family hero. They're often the, usually they are, I mean, they are the child who interrupts or comes in between this, you know, relationship and kind of, although they're welcomed and wanted perhaps, they're also the one that sort of jumps in or interferes a little bit in that first relationship. And the family hero is the person in the family who can often see and hear more of what's going on. And if only the family would listen to them, they have the solutions for how the family should be fixed and work. And they feel a tremendous sense of responsibility for the pain. They're often the person who remembers, it tries to remember everybody's birthdays in the family, tries to make sure everybody feels okay at all the gatherings. They're the person who will often try to counsel mom or dad about what's going on. And if only the family would listen, they try very hard to make things better for the family. Very hard. Trying to improve the situation. But because of the progressive nature of the disease, of course they're unable to do that. And they end up feeling a tremendous sense of inadequacy on the inside, which is greatly covered up by a lot of high-achieving behavior on the outside. This person is often very successful, gets good grades in school, has a lot of friends, often captain of the football team, cheerleader, homecoming queen, on the honor roll. They're also super responsible. They often have to assume parental behavior at a very young age. And so they often end up kind of sometimes raising the other children. Often the rest of the family looks at this person and says, you're special. Mom and dad always did like you best. They often look like they have it all together. And they also have a tremendous need for approval. And that was a role I played in my own family, and I sometimes jokingly tell people that it used to be, it was almost like I introduced myself and said, hi, my name is Jackie, how do you like me so far? because it was so important to me what people thought of me and the image instead. They also develop an independent life away from the family fairly young. They feel the pressure in the family and they will move away physically and yet emotionally are very, very tied to this family. Because what they represent to the family in keeping things balanced is self-worth. The rest of the family points to this person and says, see, our family's not so screwed up. Look at how great they're doing. And everybody finds a sense of pride in the success of this person. And so, like, this person provides a sense of responsibility. Their function in keeping the mobile balanced is to provide a sense of self-worth for everybody. Okay? Now, go ahead.
Were you always covering up then? Were you always covering up for the...
For this person?
Uh-huh.
Not so much. They often can see and hear a lot more of what's going on, and they may be willing to address it, but they also don't feel like they've been affected by that at all.
Oh.
They don't need any help. And obviously their life looks very, you know, everything looks great. Everybody thinks they're wonderful. A survey that was done a few years ago of 10 medical schools across country found that a really high percentage of physicians and medical students were family heroes coming from alcoholic families. Mm-hmm. And then we wonder why historically physicians have been really not very successful in treating this disease. A lot of them have, you know, come from it themselves.
A lot of physicians are chemically dependent themselves.
Yeah, it is a high-risk occupation.
Did that description vary between male and female at that age or that position?
Well, this person tends to marry into alcoholic families. Very often this person is at high risk for becoming this person in a relationship. They may not marry necessarily alcoholic, but they may, you know, marry or have relationships with people who are particularly dependent or needy. I don't want to get too psychoanalytic about that, but it fits, doesn't it? They often become nurses, doctors, teachers, social workers, trying to fix, you know, other families which they weren't in unable to do. Yeah.
Do most of these family heroes kind of able to maintain that role, or I've seen some that, you know, they'll be super successful in the race and then just have a break, and you know, it's one extreme to the other.
Yeah, without treatment, I mentioned that what this person tends to do is to marry into, you know, another family, another alcoholic family or relationship. They also are at high risk for cancer, this person. What we see happen with this is not as much high risk for chemical dependency early in life, but we see them in their 30s and 40s experience a lot of depression, finally going into treatment and saying, you know, I've had it, I've pooped out, I've been caretaking, you know, all my life. And I just really feel you know, I need my own help. But that denial is usually maintained for, you know, like 30, 40 years. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Doesn't that stuff kind of fall apart when they also become chemically dependent? I mean, don't firstborn children of alcoholics
not
have
as much
a higher
as
risk?
They do. One third of all children who have one alcoholic parent will become chemically dependent. Two-thirds, the risk is 80 to 90% if you have two parents who are. My recommendation to children who have either one or two parents is to get an evaluation of their own chemical use at some period in their life, and to just have an evaluation of how they're coping with life, period. But the risk is higher, not for this one as much as some of the other children I'm going to talk about. Depending on the role, not so much birth order. Because oftentimes, if you keep in mind, this person is not always older born. If maybe that the firstborn moves away from the family, somebody's got to pick up that piece, and then maybe it's the second or the third. Kind of depends on how the family progresses, rather than what order it's in. On the inside, the big feelings for family hero is guilt and inadequacy. This is also a very apologetic person, of the kind that say, you know, I'm sorry when they bump into a coffee table. They feel so responsible for everybody else's behavior. And with treatment, the thing that happens, I mentioned to you what happens if they don't go into treatment. With treatment, they can learn to make mistakes. They can learn to not be all together all the time. They can learn to be vulnerable and to take risks and express their feelings. But those are the big challenges for the person who's a family hero. The next person I want to talk about is somebody called the scapegoat. This is the person in the family that everybody points their finger at and says, if this person would straighten up, our family would be just fine. They're the person who is often expressing a lot of what's going on in the family by acting out. They're the person who's really in the family's public eye. Everybody sees what's going on with this person. And a lot of times, this is the child who gets blamed for the person's chemical use. If you had a kid that was acting like that, you know, you'd drink too, or take Valium, or get depressed, or whatever. And so that's the person who is usually pointed at. They're the school problem, the company troublemaker, the social jerk, whatever. These same dynamics I'm talking about can also go on in organizations, not just in families. And they've already learned in this family that you're not rewarded for who you are as a person, but for how you behave and what you do, obviously, right? This person is performing very well, got a lot of attention. So this person gets their attention not for the positive things that they do, but for the negative. And they're trying to prove themselves worthy, and so a lot of what they do is they pull away from the rest of the family and say, I don't want to be part of that family. I'm going to create my own family. And so often this person's peers are more important to them and their friends than the family. Family wants to do something, this person would rather be with their friends than with this. The other thing about this person is they don't in any way, shape, or form want to compete with this person. They don't want to be anything that this person was. And the role in their family, as I said, this is to provide self-worth, is that this person provides distraction and focus to the system. In other words, the person is, this is, they provide a point of blame for the family. We've got to put it somewhere. And so this is usually where it goes. So some of the things that you see going on with this person is that they have a real strong peer value. Their peers are really important to them. You see them acting out, and that may take the form of their own chemical use, getting into trouble, maybe getting pregnant at an early age. It might be being just defiant. Running away, that's right. They also are often kind of sullen. And the scapegoat is always, in many ways, they're the person who will draw attention to it. They'll say, well, look at Dad, or look at Mom. And they'll speak really for the rest of the family. One of the beautiful qualities that they have is that they really do express what's going on. And oftentimes I kind of think that the scapegoat ends up the most healthier in the family because they do learn how to get things out. And they learn, you know, that they're able to do that. Their hostility, though, is usually what, you know, pushes people away from them. People don't want to get close to them because they're so hostile all the time. With treatment, though, they are extremely sensitive. Scapegoats make very good counselors eventually if they get treatment. They need time to be listened to because often the family doesn't want to listen to them. They need confrontation. And with treatment, they can begin to see reality for the way it is and to also take responsibility. Without treatment, what we often see happen to scapegoats are they are the highest risk for becoming chemically dependent themselves. They also end up becoming troublemakers, maybe get into problems with the legal system at a pretty young age, maybe ending up in prison or in jail. They're kind of the troublemakers often. And again, the feelings on the inside, the big feelings for the scapegoat, what do you think they would be if, you know, everybody's pointing their finger at them? What do you think a big feeling would be? Low self-esteem. Also a lot of rejection. And feel a lot of blame. And pretty much alone. It's kind of like they are apart, you know, from the family in a different kind of way. But in keeping things balanced, the family needs them. You know, every family has a scapegoat. I mean, it's a matter of degree, how much people get locked into that. But the scapegoat is the person who, like I said, provides distraction to the family. Fourth person I want to talk about, and I think I'll have to erase. Two more here. Is the lost child. Oops. And this is a person, if I could kind of draw them, I would have them sitting over in the corner looking out the window, pretty far away from the family. The lost child is the one who's learned not to get too close to anybody in the family. And they're usually more disconnected from the family. They spend a lot of time alone, being quietly busy. They're the ones up in their rooms with a headset on, or drawing, or painting, or listening to music. It's safe that way. They've learned to just kind of stay busy and quiet, and they get really good at kind of being in the woodwork. And you'll see lost children just even like here on the staff at home. They're the people who it comes time to say goodbye after their 3 weeks or whatever they've been here, and we go, I didn't even know they were here. You know, they're just really kind of good at kind of sliding by. And very often when they come into treatment, lost children, they often get ignored because we think everything's okay. You know, they don't present any big problem. And that's the role that they play in the family. Is what happens is that they provide a sense of relief to the family. The family more or less says, we don't have to worry about them. They're off kind of by themselves. When in actuality, the lost child really is in a tremendous amount of pain because they're usually pretty quiet, withdrawn, distant. They're aloof. They are often overweight or struggle with compulsive eating problems. They're also super independent. They learn how to get by in this world very quickly by being by themselves. And they're also, and all of that is of course covered up in their defense. The feelings on the inside are the big ones for the lost child. Is a lot of loneliness, of course. And the other big one is rage. Lots of anger, which of course doesn't get expressed. They're real creative though. The neat thing about lost children is without treatment, what happens, sad to say, is that they end up having little zest for life. They usually have a high suicide, their higher suicide risk. They sometimes have sexual identity problems. They might become more promiscuous or stay completely alone, have difficulty with intimacy, and they often die at an earlier age. With treatment, though, it's really neat to see lost children because they are really creative, and you can see them kind of blossom. They're extremely talented. They're very self-actualized and very independent. These are the kids in families who often have imaginary friends. They can create a whole fantasy world. Oftentimes, like in schools, counselors will call, you know, them in and they have a sense that there's problems at home, and the children will say, oh, we have a great family. We go to the zoo, we go on picnics, and they live in a total fantasy world. Because in thinking about the balance of the family again, what they represent is some relief to the family. The family kind of goes, we don't have to worry about them. They're okay. They're not creating any waves. They're not getting into trouble. And what their needs are is they need a lot of consistency. They need encouragement. They need to be invited into the family. And they need to not be ignored. The last person to come along is someone that's called the mascot in the family or the family clown. And I don't know about you, but the tone of the family up to this point is pretty serious, heavy, hopeless, and along comes, you know, the last person, and they feel like somebody's got to liven things up. And so the last child, the last one often, or the mascot, is often the school clown, the joker, the social cut-up, the person who really gets the family laughing and lightens things up. Because that's what their role in the family is, to provide some sense of humor and relief to the family. They bring a lot of fun. And nobody ever takes the mascot very seriously. We don't think they really have any significant understanding of what's going on in the family. And they're often cute, fun to be with, hyperactive. You'd like to pop them a Valium because they won't sit still. They often get diagnosed with learning disabilities inappropriately. They don't actually have them, but by misdiagnosis. They'll do anything to attract attention. They clown around a lot. they're often super cute. You know, we think they're just so cute. And often this person is never allowed to grow up. The forces in the family are such that nobody ever takes them very seriously. And their cry is often, you know, please, you know, let me be older. I got a birthday card from my brother last week, and he's the youngest, and he's the baby in the family. And it was interesting because he wrote, he signed it, "Your younger brother." Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the greatest thing he, you know, he really hated was to be called, you know, the baby of the family, or the, you know, the last one. So he wanted to make sure it was described right. The feelings on the inside for the mascot is fear. If I stop laughing, what will happen? And their humor is their defense. There's a lot of insecurity. They feel they are not often privy to information in the family. The family often withholds information from this person because they're afraid they can't handle it, they're too fragile. And so they often don't know what's going on. They have a lot of fear of not belonging and a fear of breaking down. They have a lot of fear that, you know, they might just lose it if they stop clowning around. And a lot of famous comedians, I think, this is their background. And it may be that they've been able to really, you know, put it to good use. Their needs really have a lot to do with physical touch. They need to be taken seriously. They have a tremendous need to be cuddled and touched, a physical affection. They need to be given information and be invited to give input into the family. Nobody usually consults them. With treatment, and without treatment, I just want to say what we see usually happening to mascots is they develop ulcers. They have difficulty handling stress. They become compulsive clowns. They tend to marry family hero types, the oldest child, kind of that I mentioned, because family heroes are usually very serious, very responsible, and somebody needs to kind of provide that other balance. And they often remain immature. With treatment, though, they can be learn how to take care of themselves, that they don't have to be a clown all the time, that they can also have a serious side and can have a good sense of humor. I want to just say that none of these roles are necessarily awful. The problem is if the families get too rigid and people are locked in to that only kind of behavior, what you begin to see happening now is a movement called Adult Children of Alcoholics, where people are recognizing that they got locked into those patterns of surviving which worked in the family that they were in. But later in life, they're paying a price for those behaviors and realizing that they don't necessarily have to continue, and that they're experiencing some real consequences from surviving that way in the particular family at that time. And the process of treatment is almost in some ways sort of rediscovering that child within which they didn't get to be because they had to survive what was happening in the family at that particular time. So it's not necessarily all harmful. Keep in mind, it helped the family to survive at that particular time. It's only later in life that there can be some of those problems. Questions?
In the case of a lost child there, do you think if a child is born that way, or do they acquire those qualities as they get older?
As they get old?
Yes.
Well,
or are they born that way?
It's hard to separate out nature and nurture, you know, but I'm sure there's certainly innate qualities that people are like a lost child. But also, because of the dynamics in the family, people may have started out like being a lost child early on when the family needed that particular behavior to balance out. Then when all the older children are gone, they may find themselves moving into kind of a family hero role later on where they have to be more responsible. Whether they're born with it, I really couldn't say that. I think there's certainly a lot of our personality qualities are inherently kind of genetic. But a lot of it is the forces of what's going on in the family at that particular time. I don't know if we could really sort that out. So, any other questions?
could you talk to us, what you've mentioned briefly, the continuum? I mean, it's not like there's healthy families and dysfunctional families, but it's really a continuum.
Uh-huh.
That, I mean, in some ways, I guess all families are dysfunctional to one extent or another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a matter of degrees of exactly. How dysfunctional it was.
Yeah. And a lot of times when families maybe experience a stressful event or whatever, everybody kind of kicks into those roles. But at some other point, there might be more freedom in the family to sort of move around. I like to look at, you know, kind of some of the differences between a healthy family as one where self-worth is primary. How people feel about themselves is the most important thing in the family, and feeling worthwhile. Also that people can be different, that the family can tolerate diversity. It's okay to not be all like, you know, Susie, the homecoming queen, who was the oldest child. Somebody else can excel in some other way, that people can be different in the family, that not everybody has to be the same. There's a way to give feedback to one another. It's all right for the families to tell each other, you know, what they see and how they feel about it, that can freely go on. That there's explicit rules. People know what the rules are. Oftentimes in chaotic and dysfunctional families, people don't know what the rules are. They change all the time. Dad might be upset at one point at my behavior, and the next minute he'll give me a dollar to get out of his hair, you know. And it's kind of mixed messages. Also, the discipline is a growth process. When we discipline, it's done to help people grow, not to be punitive or punishment necessarily. And secrets are not tolerated. There's openness. And that change is not threatening. People can change and be different. And performance is not the most important thing, but rather who you are as a person. Those are just some qualities, I think. And a family's always striving for those at various points. So, anyway, I'll talk more about the whole process of what goes on with prime enablers in my codependency lecture. So if you want to know more about that phenomenon. What are we doing for time?
It is
almost 5:00.
Okay. I'll just close with a story about this process. It happens to helping professionals a lot. And when I was first working in the field, I was pretty naive to the whole dynamics of alcoholism. It wasn't in my own family. But I can remember I was working in an inpatient unit, and I was assigned this one particular patient who came into treatment mostly to get his wife back. She had threatened divorce and said, you know, if you don't get treatment, I'm not going to stay in the marriage, which is often, you know, the case. But then they usually end up, you know, rescinding that. Oh, okay, I'll give you one more time. And anyway, he came into treatment basically for that. And there were a lot of other complicating things going on in the family at the time. There was, I believe that there was also incest and maybe some abuse. But anyway, this guy was really putting a lot of pressure on me as his counselor to make sure I got his wife back. You know, we called her and invited her into family treatment, and she said, you know, she didn't want anything to do with this guy. And was, you know, saying, no way, no way. And he kept saying, oh, please tell her how good I'm doing. You know, he did a really good, what we call a first step in treatment, and was just trying to, you know, plead with me to get her to come back in. And finally, she consented to come in for a family session. I can remember going home that night and just worrying a lot about it. I had only been working 6 months, and I think I was only 22 at the time, and feeling a lot of pressure that, you know, this guy was putting on me and worrying about it. And I didn't sleep all night. I was worried how it was going to go, whether she'd show up, what he would say, what I would say. And, you know, I didn't sleep at all. And I walked into the nurse's station the next morning, you know, to look at this guy's chart. And I was really tired, and I opened up the guy's chart, and the nurses had charted, slept like a log. You know, and I thought, something's not quite right. I didn't sleep all night, and this guy slept fine, you know. And I was really working harder at the problem than he was. And I realized from, you know, kind of that point on that, you know, this is what happens to prime enablers. If you've been a pastor, if you've been a physician, you know what that dynamic is all about. Working harder at, you know, somebody else's problem. So, anyway, I'll close with that. Thank you.
Thank you.